Mr. Herbert, could you tell me where you were born?
Calgary, Alberta.
What year is that?
1924.
Did you go to school in Calgary?
Yes, I did. Finished high school there, and approximately the time I became 18 years old, and that's when I joined the Air Force.
Did you go to the Central Collegiate Institute?
Central Collegiate High.
Oh, that's a high school, is
well,
it?
Well, it's called CCI, you're right, yeah.
I see. What did your parents, what was your father's occupation?
He was a switchman with the railway. He's really a machinist, but he was killed when he was working as a switchman with the railway in 1929. When I was 4 years old. CPR, yeah.
Where are your parents from?
Well, he was from Nova Scotia. My mother was born in Ogden, Utah. And they met in the West.
I see. While you were in high school, did you join a local militia?
Yes, I did. I belonged to an organization called the 15th Alberta Light Horse.
What was that organization?
Well, it was, theoretically, when I joined it, a cavalry unit. And we were the headquarters squadron in Calgary, and the other squadrons comprising the unit were places like Pincher Creek and Bowden, Alberta. And at summer camp, the rural fellows brought horses, and at the time I joined, but we were theoretically at that day, of course, convertible to petrol-driven vehicles.
I think
we were a little out of date, you might say.
Why did you join this unit?
Oh, I was interested in military activity, and a friend belonged to it, and I enjoyed it.
Was your parent, or was your father in the services?
No. I concluded that when my father wasn't in the services, I most of my uncles did. Several were lost in the First World War.
When you joined this militia unit, this was 1939.
No, it would be later than that. It would be in late 1940 or early 41, as I recall. I just don't remember now. It's written down somewhere, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I should add, maybe, that my older brother had served in the Lord Strathcona Horse in the peacetime regular army. And that would be roughly between 38 and 39, and I've no doubt that influenced me at that age to have a run at it too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What did you do after you were with this militia unit?
Well, the 15th Alberta Light Horse got itself mobilized when I was about 17 into a thing called the 31st Reconnaissance Regiment and disappeared into the mythical 6th Canadian Division. I was then not old enough, of course, to join the regular force, so I transferred to the Calgary Regiment Tank and served with it until I was 18 years old when I joined the Air Force.
Why did you switch to the Air Force?
I wanted to fly.
Where were you based when you joined the Air Force?
Well, initially one went through a scheme of training, and it was mostly in Western Canada. For example, you'd go to Edmonton for initial, or for Manning Depot, Claresholm, Alberta, back to Edmonton again, to High River, to Calgary, back to Edmonton again, then to Defoe, Saskatchewan, Rivers, Manitoba, and from thence overseas.
I see. What were you training for?
Well, I wanted to be a fighter pilot, but they didn't think I could fly, and I started off as a pilot, and I finished elementary school and most of service flying, but I was washed out and reselected. I wanted the shortest course they had available. That appeared to be this bomb aimer thing, so I retrained in that activity.
How did it come about that you went overseas?
Well, I, like most fellows, I sort of wanted to, and although many young fellows were retained to become instructors and so on in the Commonwealth Air Training Plan, most guys wanted to get overseas and get into the...
So which squadron were you posted?
Well, ultimately, after going through a long, quite a long course of training at various places in England and Wales, I ended up on a squadron called 429 Squadron at a place called Leaming in Yorkshire, which was part of the six bomber group, the Canadian bomber group of the Royal Air Force.
Could you give the dates for that?
Oh, golly, off the top of my head. It would be roughly June of 44. It was just around the time of D-Day. Well, perhaps a little later than that. I know a month or so later than that, actually, that I got to the squadron and began to operate. So it was really through the last half of 1944 that I was on operations.
Mm-hmm. And what war experience did you have?
Well, the normal for a regiment then for a bomber crew was to do, the tour was approximately 30 trips. And when you'd completed a so-called operational tour, you were screened. And about the time we were nicely into that, of course, the Americans had broken out in France. It looked like the war was galloping to a conclusion. And although some of my crew, at least myself, we wanted to go on and do further work by going into Pathfinders, it looked like a kind of a dumb idea. We might get embarked on another program of training and have the whole war end up on us never having, you know, finished a tour. So we elected not to do so. And then when we finished our tour, a few of us wanted to go on, but we went rather to staff and instructor jobs, again within the command. I was mining officer at 63 base, which involved some planning and evaluation of laying mines from aircraft.
Mm-hmm. When you
until
were
the end of the war.
Yes, when you were on the tour, what did you do bombing then?
Yeah.
What did you do, for example?
Well, I usually run the things for that time. We did some bombing of flying bomb sites, because then the Germans were launching these buzz bombs in England.
Uh-huh.
And some close support bombing with the army activities in Normandy. A considerable amount of laying of mines in, for example, Kiel Bay, but mostly in Norwegian waters, and that would be interspersed with the more typical bombing raid on German centers.
I see. What was the purpose of laying the mines?
Well, basically to inhibit German seaborne traffic. The bombing effort, to a considerable degree, was devoted in one way or another to inhibiting German communications, and the laying of sea mines, obviously, in Norwegian waters was to preclude the sea traffic between Denmark, Germany, and Norway. And the Germans had very considerable forces in Norway, and part of the idea was to at least inhibit their movement of men and material from Norway back to Germany.
Yes, Germany was importing a lot of iron ore from through Norwegian ports.
Well, yes, in a sense. The great iron ore run, of course, was from northern Sweden across to Narvik and far northern Norway, and then down what they called the Leads, that is Norwegian coastal waters, through to Germany. Although I believe that traffic had been inhibited at my time, at any rate, in another way, and that would be by direct attack by coastal command aircraft. We were really concerned with the shipping out of places like Oslo and Sandefjord, which was primarily personnel, as I understood it.
Mm-hmm. You said that after your tours, now you were on ground staff.
Yes.
And this was for instruction, did you say?
No, I was, because I think I had done quite a bit of this mine-laying work, and it was a large amount, at least, of the responsibility for it fell upon the bomb aimer, and had written a sort of short paper on the experiences. It was deemed appropriate that I be made a kind of staff officer, and I became what was called the mining officer for 63 base, and I functioned out of the headquarters in both the briefing crews on further mining activities and in the assessment of the results of their work for reporting to the Admiralty and other agencies. It was really quite interesting, you know, fairly scientific.
So, what did you do after the war?
Well, I volunteered to go to Japan, but the cowards quit because of the atom bomb, I guess you could put it that way. And so I was in mid-Atlantic when they, theoretically on my way to further training for going out to the Far East when the war in the East ended. And accordingly, we were reposted shortly to release depots of our choice, and I determined the most advantageous thing for me to do was to go to university, and hence I came to Vancouver, where my parents and my mother and brother had moved, and came to UBC in the fall of 1945.
Did you at this time contemplate a career in the forces?
No.
Which faculty did you enter into at UBC?
Well, in the first instance, arts, but my intention was to go into law, which I did in due course.
How did you become interested in law?
Well, two reasons. I think my brother had always wanted to be a lawyer. He's a chartered accountant, but at that time, in the 30s, there were no resources to send him to any university, and he accordingly got his education in that way and in that profession. But he always wanted to be a lawyer, and I had a very, very close friend in the air training scheme in Canada, a chap named Bishop, who practices law in Edmonton, and I admired him very much, and I thought if that's what lawyers are like, they can't be all bad, and maybe I'd like to be one. I think probably I had some bent that was not in the direction of mathematics and science. And another factor I think that affected many of us was that at that time at UBC, there was no medical school or dental school. The sort of professional training available was confined really to engineering and forestry, that sort of thing, and the law school was new, and it consequently attracted people for that reason.
Yes, I think the law school started right after, about 1945.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what degree did you attain in law school?
Well, I have an arts degree and a law degree.
Did you practice law?
For a short time, about a year.
What happened after that?
Well, I came back to UBC teaching. An opportunity arose to do that, and I've really been doing that substantially ever since.
Did you keep any connections with the Air Force after the war?
Well, not immediately, but with the growth of the 19 wing of what was called the Auxiliary Air Force here in Vancouver, the reserve units, an opportunity occurred to join it, and I joined 19 wing, in specifically the Aircraft Control and Warning Unit, and served in that for a couple of years when I was asked to take up the appointment of commanding officer of the what was then called the Reserve University Squadron at UBC.
Where was this auxiliary squadron based?
At Sea Island.
At Sea Island?
Yeah.
What kind of duties did you have at this particular base as far as routine? And
well, with them, we were a kind of a fighter control unit, theoretically. The trouble is we were equipped with Ames 11 radar gear, which was a mobile gear designed to go ashore on the continent during the latter part of the war, and its effective use depended on its being serviceable, the VHF being serviceable, the aircraft being serviceable all at one time, and this frequently didn't occur. We were also inhibited in our aerial surveillance by the existence of all the mountains around here, so that in practical terms, we weren't a great organization, but it was a very good unit in terms of preparing for the use of more sophisticated and better equipment as this one that might become
available.
This is a
reserve unit.
A reserve unit, yes.
So you would attend the unit once a week?
One night a week and all day Sundays was the routine.
How did this unit interact with the Reserve University Squadron, which started off roughly around this time, 1948-49?
Yeah, essentially, it was an interesting phenomenon. There was not a very clear-cut or close connection. And this was something that I tried to overcome, having had the advantage of serving with it and then coming into the officer training. I knew that there was an area where new officers were going to be needed, and it seemed to me that one of my functions would be to expedite the movement of the people I was concerned with training and administering in due course into the auxiliary, and I think that to some degree we succeeded in this activity. It made it all a bit more purposeful and of use to the defense scene to try and do that. The trouble is the auxiliary, you see, was under Air Defense Command, and the officer training at UBC was under Training Command, and the two commands were separated physically and in terms of personnel, and it seemed to me to need some kind of connecting link. When I was able to facilitate the acceptance of people from the university scheme into the auxiliary scheme.
I read in the UBC annual of that year that the students in the university unit would go to Sea Island quite often during the year.
Well, I was, of course, a successor to Squad Leader Haynes, who was the first commanding officer of the university flight, as it was first called, and then squadron. And initially, the students in university units from the east trained in the east, and those from the west trained at Abbotsford the first year. And they were not brought together until the second year when the school moved to London, Ontario. And then the next year, they, from all over Canada, they met at Royal Military College Kingston. It was not until really the following year that I was involved in their active training. What did occur, of course, was that, for example, an officer cadet who had completed his basic officer training in one of those summers might well indeed be posted, let's say if he was in administration or supply, to a place like Sea Island to get the on-the-job experience, which was the balance really of his training.
Did students ever go to Sea Island during the winter term though?
Oh, no, not really, except in the sense that we kitted the people, supply that is, out of Sea Island. There was a financial connection. They handled our pay and accounts, and there was some social interchange.
You said that you saw that with the auxiliary squadron at Sea Island, the university unit could therefore be a source of supply of new men,
right?
New personnel. Did this work the other way too? For example, would officers, experienced officers, servicemen at Sea Island, help out your unit in some capacities?
Yes, indeed so. As I say, particularly in regards to this furnishing of administrative assistance, we drew on them fairly occasionally for winter lectures on various phases of Air Force activity. But I must say that primarily, our training program was basic, and what we tried to utilize because of the unique availability were academic people from the university in particular areas of current affairs, history, and so on. We had a basic feeling that the kind of service instruction was best done in the service context in the summer. Although, no, we fairly frequently called upon serving officers available in the area to contribute to the training program, but in addition to university people.
I see.
Well, let me give you an example of what I'm thinking of. You get a guy who's taking commerce or something like that, it happens to be an officer cadet. It's a damn good idea if he gets exposed to some real good contemporary instruction about geography and geopolitics and so on. He's going to be an officer, and this was a good opportunity to do that. Broadened their interest, caught their attention. We had a fairly flexible training program. It was not, I think, as rigid as that imposed by the other two services. We were a little more free to exploit resources at hand than perhaps the others were.
I'd like to ask your opinion on a few events. In 1943, a university squadron started up and lasted only for about a year and a half. What is your opinion on why that happened, why it was disbanded?
Well, I can only guess. I was overseas at the time that all that occurred, but I perceive it in this way, that the Canadian government determined that as long as all male, fit male university students still attending a university, it was desirable they complete their education for the general effort of the country, but they thought it equally important that these men be required to take whatever military training could be made available at the same time, and hence the COTC became a very, very large and substantial organization. And as we talked the other day, the Air Force tended, for one reason or another, and principally because it was actively engaged to attract people. You know, it was technical, it offered flying, and it was engaged in operations right from sort of day one of the war, whereas the Army was held in England in a defensive and training role for a very extended period of time. So consequently, a lot of university students, as they completed their education or otherwise, joined the Air Force. I have no doubt this was the impulse of sort of starting up a specialist university flight or squadron in the university. But equally so, by 1944, the Commonwealth Air Training Plan was really running down. They had all the people they needed or could foresee being needed, and consequently, I suppose it was just plain economics to cut out, you know, one more source of supply that was not necessary.
So why was it reestablished in 1949?
Well, in 49, typically in Canada, right after the war, in 45, you know, the service was just reduced right down from hundreds of thousands of people to very few thousand. And, however, the world didn't get all that peaceful that quickly, or it became unpeaceful again, and one will recollect there was a great deal of tension between an expansionist Russia, as it appeared, and the European community, and it saw the birth of NATO, but perhaps principally it was the outbreak of the quite serious major war in Korea between the forces of left and right, I suppose one would put it that way, that led to a kind of reassessment of our defensive capability and posture, hence an expansion in the services, and hence a sudden need again for the introduction of what, with the increasingly sophisticated equipment, seemed to people to be increasingly sophisticated people in terms of education, in particularly in the sciences, engineering and the like, so that this reopening of a unit on the campus seemed to be a good source of supply. And indeed, it wasn't very long after the units were reinstituted that in, would it be 52, I guess, that the services went even further and set up a scheme of subsidization called the Regular Officer Training Plan, by which they would encourage the entry of university students into the service by enrolling them in the service and paying their way through university.
Yes. You mentioned earlier that you became commanding officer. That'd be 1952.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, rather curiously, I had heard there were a couple of law students that belonged to the reserve squadron, and one of them came to me one day and said, "You know, Herbert, they're looking for a CO for the Air Force unit, And I rather gathered that they were, one, looking for somebody on faculty, obviously. Two, they were looking for somebody, I think, who had had aircrew experience and sported a wing and a few ribbons and so on. That added a little bejazz to the thing. And accordingly, I really just volunteered. At that time, I was supposed to be going away to graduate work, so I just simply wandered over and asked if there was any way I could be of assistance. And that was more or less taken up, and I was appointed commanding officer.
Taken up by the committee that governed military affairs on campus?
Well, no, it was briefer than that. Sperrin Chant, who was then the Dean of Arts and the next director of Manning for the RSAF, I was sitting in his office, and he picked up the phone and phoned the chief of the air staff and said, "I've got a CO for you." And that was about the size of it.
Did you know your predecessor, Mr.
Roy Haynes?
Yes.
Rather better later than then. I hadn't really known him well. I'd seen him and knew of him, but I became really more acquainted with him after I had taken over and he had gone back into the regular force.
I see. Mm-hmm. That was why he left the unit then, because he was going
to rejoin the
regular force.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you think when you took over as commanding officer? You had quite a large facility in the Army. I wonder what your impressions of the Army were.
Well, I was obviously very impressed with the offices, the people, the staff, the resident staff officer then was Flight Lieutenant W.P. Casey of the regular force. The clerk in charge of the order room was a Corporal Stride, who ended out his career as a warrant officer. There was Flight Lieutenant Lathwaite from the Physical Education Department, who was the sort of 2IC, and a very friendly group, not merely in the Air Force side of things, but with the COTC and the Navy as well, with whom I immediately became acquainted.
Can I read, I'd like to read you a quote. This would be from your commanding officer's report, and you can comment on it. This is 1953. "The accommodation made available to the service units at UBC cannot be approached by any similar units anywhere in Canada." What do you have to...
Well, that's quite correct. We were the envy of everybody from here east, as far as they had units established at universities, and in terms of this facility we had, in which we perhaps took an inordinate pride because of the way in which it was built. It was really built by the students, like so many things at UBC, and we're always inclined to be a little hoopy in the west, but we were the only outfit I know that had a mess and an armories and offices and really support that we got that this university was unique. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you about the parade evenings. You started with a mess dinner. Is that the case?
Well, this has had sort of a varied kind of situation. In those days, there was a lady, and I can't think of her name, but one of the Army people will, Mrs. Davis, who was sort of a cook in the kitchen, a fairly adequate kitchen that existed in our mess, a little one, but at the end of the place, and she served lunches in the armories for those who, you know, wished to purchase them at a very moderate rate, and each parade night she served a meal for those who, again, wished to attend it. We tried to develop this because it seemed like a good idea. The more people we could get out to kind of dine together, and we used to jazz it up a little later on. We introduced the idea of serving some wine and so on, and just a general attempt to pull the thing together, this business of giving the unit the sort of a corporate feeling. And when she stopped later on, we had food catered and brought in from food services for the same purpose.
I see. In the Thiel reports, quite fortunate for me because I was able to get a very good picture of what Ypres Deepings were like, mm-hmm. because for your 1956 report you enclosed a synopsis of each parade. One impression I got, maybe you can confirm this or deny it, was that the first lecture following the dinner tended to be more, or following first you have dinner and then drill, inspection by the commanding officer, and then the first lecture seemed to be more specific of the evening, and then the second lecture tended to be one of more general interest. I wonder, is that correct, or?
I don't know if I could recollect any particular thing, except it may be responsive to that, to say that we would try to arrange the lecture schedule to accommodate the convenience of anybody we might have brought in for that purpose. For example, we might get Dr. Robinson from geography set for a lecture, and we would invite him for supper beforehand, but if he couldn't come and he preferred to come at a different hour, we would adjust our schedule to meet his convenience.
So it was kind of a flexible setup.
Well, I think so, yeah. The invariable sequence was the inspection, the drill, and then into whatever classes we could fit in. A good deal of the time of the actual officers was spent, particularly in the fall period, in doing interviews of the prospective applicants. It took a lot of time, of course.
Yes. I was going to get to that. I wanted to ask you, you gave lectures yourself, didn't you?
Oh yeah, from time to time.
What kind of topics did you tend to deal with?
Oh, they varied a good deal, I suppose. That I used to do a famous illustrated one on the blackboard, the comparative service ranks, with appropriate characteristics, how you could tell a soldier from a sailor and so on. It usually was well received. But it varied. I can recall at one time, very early in the thing, because I had done a kind of letter discussion group in the auxiliary on the situation in the Middle East, in particular reference to Egypt. And having notes and stuff ready, I bunged that at the guys, just for the hell of it. But we were pretty much occupied, as I say, in terms of time with the interviewing of people, applicants.
I was noticing that in 1 year, it seemed like you wouldn't start the parade until about the usually after the first week in October. Presumably September was taken up mostly with recruiting.
Yeah, that would have been perhaps a little unusually late, but that would be the cause, probably.
Yeah. And I counted the number of parade nights, which would be maybe 15 or 16 in 1 year.
Yes.
That seemed to me not too much. I wonder what we achieved in that period of time.
In some senses, you see, we were... We had a limit on the pay that the cadets could earn in the course of the winter. This was kind of a governing factor. We probably were a little overgenerous in assigning a per diem rate to our parade system, but broadly speaking, it was designed to accommodate the pay that DMD was ready to make available on a per diem basis to cadets for training purposes. We think we ran ours over, actually, the hours, because of the additional activities in connection with preparation for the tri-service parades and ball and that sort of thing.
Yeah, in the Thiel report, it also mentions pay parades, and I wonder what these were.
It was when the laddie came out from Sea Island with the money for the troops.
Would this be like a regular parade or just a...
Oh, no, pay parades are a beautiful thing. It's a table and the guys there with a whole bundle of money. This was before we got into the check era. Mm-hmm. And by the quittance roll, and each people lined up and stepped up smartly and suited and were handled a bundle of money and signed the quittance roll, and the boat turned and then went back to the next table where we collected their messages from them. Often with the result there was little netted out of it, but still it was fun.
I'm going to ask you a question, a rather large question. I wonder if you could describe summer training and how it was. The importance of summer training. say, compared with the winter parade night, what was learned there?
Well, I regarded really you've got to sort of separate a little bit into the levels of the individual. Now, we really ran a different training program depending on whether a guy was parading in his first, his second, or his third year in the winter. You know, the outline of the parade remained essentially the same. All would participate in the drill, but by and large, the senior guys took charge of the drill. That is, cadets, officer cadets in third year, many of by then who were pilot officers had been actually commissioned, we encouraged them to take a large part in the running of the mess, in running the drill program, in arranging the roster of officers in charge of each flight, and it was a flight for first year, second year, and third year, and being the sort of parade CO, and we'd rotate them through this because it's a wonderful developer of confidence in people to have to do that kind of thing. A lot of people laugh at drill, but it's got a very, very real purpose, and it's the way in which one inculcates both discipline on those being drilled and the ability to give it, as it were, on the part of those who should develop that capacity. It's a very important part of officer development.
Now, summer training, this was...
As I indicated perhaps earlier, that we tried as much as we could to exploit the talent available in the university to provoke interest, purpose, and so on in being in the service at all. And we relied to quite an extent on the sort of basic instruction we might call military subjects as occurring in the first phase of first year summer training. And this is this reserve officer school conducted variously, as I've indicated initially, in Abbotsford for Western universities and for all universities of London, and for 4 years at Royal Military College Kingston, then for 3 or 4 years, I forget now, at Collège Militaire, then for 3 or 4 years at Centralia, Ontario, and in the final year at Clinton, Ontario, before this thing folded up. Initially, we ran really two reserve, or extended reserve officer school. Then we had aircrew training. The basic reserve officer school was 6 weeks duration, at the end of which time the aircrew left. The aeronautical engineers and the electronics people, those going on specific further courses, left. And we were left then with a residue of and I don't use that word in any invidious sense, but a residue of things like supply, administration, phys ed, those sorts of categories of officer cadets who did a further 4 weeks at the reserve officer school, but of a more advanced nature, the basic thrust of the training being service management. Because they were then going out to be trained on the job, as it were, and they wanted to be equipped so that they could take over as an assistant adj or acting adjutant, and so we did it in that way at first. Later on, when the aircrew training was diminished, we really ran a shorter course for everybody. It became more compressed. Perhaps we got a little more efficient at it. In the early days, for example, we gave them an extensive exercise, if you like, in ground defense, which was virtually infantry training of an elementary sort. That diminished over the years. I think, in my view, it was a mistake, but again, the time and availability of instructors and so on were factors in these decisions.
First year cadets would go through an indoctrination period when they first went to summer camp.
Yeah, you call it indoctrination. It's not a word I like, but I prefer to call it basic training, something of that kind.
I was curious about one aspect of it. It said there was a public speaking course.
Yes, indeed. Well, the title we used was effective speaking. Mm-hmm. The theory behind that is that you're going to be an officer. You're basically going to be a manager of some kind or a supervisor of some kind. Whatever your trade is, you're still instructing or and directing other people, and it's highly relevant that a person develops some confidence in his capacity to stand on his hind legs and say something. So we had a course designed to achieve that effect.
How did the cadets respond to that?
Oh, very well. Yeah, one of their favorites. Oh. In the same way, we gave them a course called Service Writing. And this was designed to acquaint them with military parlance in part, but primarily, in my view, to teach them to write a simple, straight, goddamn letter or message. It's a very useful thing for university students.
Did you attend summer camps yourself?
Yes.
What did you ordinarily do at a summer camp?
Well, my chores varied. I early became involved in being in charge the first year I was supposed to do service law, that stemmed from my, I suppose, legal training, although I didn't particularly know that much about service law. I got involved in a number of administrative chores, and ultimately, really, I became kind of a lecturer in service history and organization, which were subjects that I knew quite a bit about and was very interested in. And then as the years went by, I took charge of all outdoor activities and, you know, sort of overseeing them. That would be the drill, phys ed, and those spaces of things in a very profound way, but designated as the guy overseeing those activities and quite a variety of things.
This summer camp coincided quite nicely with your own job, of course.
Well, of course, yes,
when
I was through with the exams in the spring and was free then to go on this activity. One of the great things and my happiest recollections of it were the number of other university people I met from all over Canada who came in a similar manner to myself to help staff these schools. I made some friends I'll never forget. They came from all kinds of disciplines and activities in universities, so it was a real good thing for a parochial guy like me who, you know, taught in a very narrow area in a law school.
The same would apply to the cadets.
And equally so with the cadets. I'd like to say something there before, you know, we go on. That it, to me, in a period of time when we were, there was a lot of concern about, developing concern about sort of Quebec in Canada and Quebec's feelings for independence and that movement generally, which was tends to have been led, I think, and sparked by really self-styled intellectual leaders, but at any rate, people from higher education institutions and so on. I thought that from my own point of view, which is a very kind of nationalistic Canadian one, I suppose, that the bringing together of a large number of young men from Laval and Montreal and other Quebec education institutions, along with others of the same age and interests from all across the country, and socking them together, and we mixed them up deliberately, produced, to my mind, a wonderful effect. None of those people will ever forget, I don't think, the associations engendered in that way. Mind you, I think probably one could say that perhaps the young men from French Canada who volunteered for this kind of training might not have been entirely typical, and indeed, I was going to add, even though for a number of years the school was conducted in a Quebec community, the value of that alone to the young men from the West and the Maritimes to really live in a Quebec community was better than several million dollars worth of biculturalism or B&B commission activity. It went to the heart of the matter.
Cadets would have had a first-hand acquaintance with the...
Sure, to the French
Quebec
Canadian
culture.
Community, sure.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
One thing, at the summer basis, the cadets were treated as if they had the status of commissioned officers. This is what I read in one of the reports.
Well, that's a little exaggerated. By and large, the cadets were quartered, as would be the Royal Military College cadets, obviously, in their courses of activity in the winters. And we tended to set up a cadet mess as distinct from the officer's mess as such on these stations, simply because of the numbers to be handled. In other words, they would dine more cafeteria style and we might dine with waiters. But the feature of all these training programs was joint mess style dinner with all the trimmings and a speaker and the conventions of the service and the church parade and some of these things that were perhaps uniquely military.
Right.
But otherwise, they were harried around a good deal. Their drill instruction, you see, would be given by NCOs of the RSAF. Drill instructors supervised by an officer, and of course these men are uniquely capable of taking a gang of people and making them feel small and good and everything else, all the same process, but instilling in them a sense of competition and pride in their appearance and activity. And we tried to make these in the latter years of the training. We induced a lot of what we call flight competition, both in drill and particularly in sports. Mm. And to enhance that, we brought in as flight commanders recent graduates of RMC. It was a good experience for them, too.
Mm.
And there was a good deal of leadership that was displayed in that regard. Again, earlier, when the scheme was bigger, we used to run a joint sports meet. Squad Major Lathwaite, broadly speaking, ran because he was, you know, a guy who really knew the phys ed business. And this would bring in cadets from all over southern Ontario, wherever they were available from whatever year of training, for a big mass track meet at Kingston, and that was a great success.
I was wondering, say in the case of air crew training, after three summers,
yes,
what level of skill could a cadet attain?
Well, when I first began, at any rate, the flying training was confined to the Harvard aircraft, and it was all through flying on the Harvard, or all through training on the Harvard. And, you know, that's the so-called advanced two-seat trainer from World War II. And by the time the guy completed three summers of that, he was a pilot of very considerable competence. As I say, there was a weakness in the training, I suppose, in the sense that it was interrupted by the winter session. But there was a strength in it, too, in that it was there was a degree of repetition and rehashing of it, of course, and it was quite intensive in order to get the hours in requisite to reach wing standard. One of the problems, of course, occurred when the jet became the airplane, and it was deemed requisite that really every pilot be trained to jet standard. And it's my belief that the break in continuity of the training and the lack of the cost factor involved were one of the main reasons why they decided to eliminate reserve air crew training.
Yeah.
At least it would be a large factor, and that would be coupled with the desire to, evident by the disappearance of 19 Wing from Vancouver, to eliminate the auxiliary wherever politics permitted that to be done.
Mm-hmm. Did some of the cadets get jet training, though?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. After
we had another scheme that went on at the same time, where if a kid wanted to take a year out of university, we could get him into air crew that way. He'd be gone for a year. It was called short service commission training. He'd go through that and then into the auxiliary. And a number of the fellows did that, particularly if they weren't selected on the initial selection but had the aptitudes. Maybe their marks weren't so good or some other factor didn't appeal to the board. They'd say, okay, I'll take a year out, sir, and university and go and do my training. Come back, and a number of them did that. Of course, they then had the advantage of continuity of training right through the jet standard. Came back, joined the auxiliary, came back to university, and were lost to my unit, but in the right place doing the right thing. There were a number of fellows that did that.
Would they have been able to get a pilot's license after this period?
Oh yeah, a private pilot selection sheet we get after these days about 35 hours of instruction in a light aircraft.
What are some of these, do you know some of these cadets did go into commercial flying?
Yes. Mm. One crosses my mind, Dennis Clark. A number of them went into the auxiliary and well, just by way of example, there's a judge of the Supreme Court now, John Bouck, B-O-U-C-K, his former law partner, Jack Edwards, went through the Harvard training, got their wings, joined the auxiliary, converted in the auxiliary or with the auxiliary to T-Birds, the jet trainer, on from then to Sabre aircraft, back from that to expediters and the big float plane, the final equipment of the auxiliary, the Otter, de Havilland Otter, and Edwards became a wing commander and CO of one of the auxiliary squadrons. John Buck was a squadron leader in one of them, and there were other examples of that. Uh-huh. So that the basic training was sound, the adaptability. I had my first jet flight with Jack Edwards. He was then back in law school as a law student. He had hiatus. He graduated in commerce, decided to come back to law. You know, I went up on Wednesday afternoon, went zopping around the Gulf in the bird. Great experience.
One more question on summer camp, summer training, I should say. Some cadets were posted overseas, and they were selected on a merit basis.
Yes,
what
was the theory.
What qualities?
Well, there were a number of factors that operated in selection for those going overseas. A large number would be excluded right away because they're committed to finishing technical courses, which was a pity, but there it was. There's not enough time left at university for them to both complete their course and go off to Europe for a summer. So actually the group from which selections could be made was very narrow. It might be narrowed further than that by the overseas requirement for trades. So we're really getting down to quite a small group of people. And within that framework, it was damn difficult to sort of pick who should go. And of course, these postings were much, much sought after. And I'm sure we made mistakes in selection. You're bound to do so. But on the whole, it seemed to work reasonably well. And those who got a real plum out of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. All that Air Force expense.
Yeah. Yes, by and large, even if they might have been eligible, I tended to try and pick reserve students for the experience on the kind of vague theory that a regular force guy would ultimately get over anyhow, probably, you know. Whereas the reserve person would be unlikely to have an opportunity like that.
Yes.
But within that kind of framework, the theory was merit.
Uh-huh.
Which would be a reflection of a guy's interest in activity and academic standing and the kind of contribution we judged he made to the squadron's activity.
After graduation and completion of the three-year program,
yes,
what rank would a person normally get in if he joined one of the reserve
units? Flying officer. Yeah, pilot officer was really kind of an interim commission rank, latterly.